Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 5th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, using tiny video cameras to study how crows use tools in the wild, a downside to breeding fish in captivity, and making your lab and scientific conference environmentally friendly. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
In laboratory studies over the past few years, crows have shown a surprising ability to use simple tools to obtain food. But what about the tests of nature? How do crows use tools in the wild? In a paper published online this week by Science, Kristen Rutz and colleagues report on new insights into the behavior of crows. To get those insights, the scientists used some inventive tools of their own, tiny video cameras that they attached to the bird's tail feathers. I spoke with Rutz from his office at Oxford University.
This paper is about sticking video cameras to wild birds. And it is really about pioneering a new research technique which enables us to address questions that couldn't be addressed with conventional observation techniques with wild birds.
What had led you to this new research technique?
When we prepared our first expedition to New Caledonia to study the New Caledonian crow, we researched whatever was available on the species, and we soon discovered that it is apparently very difficult to study these birds in the wild because they are very sensitive to human disturbance, and they also live in a habitat that is mountainous and very forested, so birds are difficult to observe. And so we thought we should have a technology that allows us to get very close, very intimate observations without disturbing the birds.
And what did you do exactly with these cameras?
What we did is we developed very, very small cameras, little spy cams, as it were, that can be attached to wild free-ranging birds. And these cameras transmit a video signal to custom-built receivers. So we can capture video footage from wild birds. And basically, we can hitch a ride with a New Caledonian crow as it is roaming the forest in New Caledonia.
Did you see anything that hadn't been observed before in the lab?
Yes, we did. We actually made a few surprise discoveries. So, for example, we observed on one occasion how a crow used a tool on the ground. And that was very surprising indeed, because so far it was thought that this species' tool use is mainly targeted at rotting wood, where the crows extract grubs from the wood with their tools, or possibly in tree crowns where they probe little holes and crevices. But to see the birds using tools on the ground showed that the niche they exploit with their tools is much larger than previously thought.
Is it any possibility that the cameras might have weighed the birds down?
No, I don't think so. We pilot tested this technique extensively here in the lab. We were very fortunate to have some 15 crows here in the lab in Oxford that allowed us to use prototype tags to see whether the crows are happy with the tags, and also to see whether we would get the video footage we wanted from wild birds. And of course, the very reason why we came up with the idea to develop this technique was we wanted to see undisturbed behavior. So anything that would have affected the birds would have been not in the interest of the project.
And what kind of views are you getting? How long of a footage are you getting? And what do you see?
Well, these cameras broadcast the signal and they transmit a microwave video signal. And this transmission is very energy hungry, so it depletes batteries quickly. And although we use the best battery technology that is currently available, the cameras only last for about 70 minutes. And on average, we get about 30 minutes of good video reception per bird. And that might sound very little, but in total, from 18 camera deployments, we got 7.5 hours of video footage. And within this time, we observed much more than we observed during hundreds of hours of conventional radio telemetry.
Other than just foraging behavior, can you gather anything else with these cameras?
There is some evidence suggesting that parts of this unusual tool use behavior in New Caledonian crows is transmitted socially, so that there might be a culture of tool technology. And any such cultural transmission will, of course, depend on the interaction of individuals with each other. So we are very much interested in the social context of tool use in these crows. And of course, these video cameras are suitable for filming other crows. And we do indeed have within our video database, we indeed have already recordings where camera tag crows filmed other crows, some of which wore wing tags, so they were identifiable.
Are you able to keep track even after the cameras get maybe torn off by the birds, or of which crow is which?
Yes, that's not a problem. And I should mention that these camera units contain a tiny little radio tag, an integrated radio tag that is for positional tracking of the bird. So we really have merged two technologies, the radio telemetry on the one hand that enables us to follow individual birds and establish their position in time and space, but then the video technology on top of that. So we can establish what we call the foraging trajectory of a bird, and we know exactly where the bird is. And the integration of this little radio tag into the camera unit was really key to the success of this project, because when we capture the video footage with our video receivers, we have to know approximately where the bird is, because these receivers are very directional, and that is where the radio tags come into play.
Who else might benefit from this technology?
I think many field ornithologists will have very good ideas of how they could use these video cameras for studying their study species. And this technology is, of course, not limited to researching New Caledonian crows. Any animal of more than, I would say, 320, 330 grams would be suitable for wearing these tags. And I hope that this video tracking technology will inspire many other field ornithologists, and they will make good use of this technology.
So what's next along this research path for you?
We certainly want to deploy many more cameras. So with the 18 cameras we deployed last field season, we feel that we have established the technique. We are confident that we can get the footage we need for scientific analyses. And now we really want to get larger sample sizes. And the reason behind that is we want to get quantitative material that will enable us to look in detail at the foraging ecology, not just of the species, but of individual birds. So we want to gather quantitative data for individual crows as they forage in the forest and as they use their tools.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Christian Hutz is lead author of a paper on new insights into tool use by New Caledonian crows, published online this week by Science. Read the paper and watch some of the videos on our website at www.scienceexpress.org. Also in science this week, it's been 50 years since the Soviet Union successfully launched Sputnik 1, the world's first artificial satellite. With a mass of 93 kilograms and taking about 98 minutes to orbit the Earth, the basketball-sized satellite sent out radio signals that people all over the world tuned in to hear on shortwave radios. Here's a recording of Sputnik's signal from NASA, though the United States Space Agency itself wasn't created until nearly a year after this recording was made. Read an editorial, two perspectives, and a book review related to the anniversary of Sputnik 1 and the space race that began with a beep. Scientists have been using captive breeding, or breeding in hatcheries, to restore declining wildlife populations. But the sustainability of such hatchery programs is largely untested. In a paper in this week's Science, Hitoshi Araki and colleagues report that the first two generations of steelhead trout bred in hatcheries have had very little reproductive success as compared with wild trout populations. It's a finding that could have big implications for conservationists trying to restore some endangered fish populations. I spoke with Araki from his office at Oregon State University.
What we found is by recycling hatchery fish in hatchery, we see the unexpectedly low fitness of hatchery fish in the wild. That's this paper is all about.
Now, why is this important? I mean, hatchery programs are typically designed, aren't they, for producing fish for harvest the very next year?
That is exactly correct. But now we taking the second step to use those hatchery practice for specifically conservation goals. And even for the production purpose, we release huge amount of hatchery juveniles in the wild, and they are definitely interacting to the wild fish in many ways, including reproductive interaction. So this is a concern for not specifically for the supplementation program, but also the hatchery in general.
Okay, so it sounds like the problem then is that the captively bred fish, the hatchery fish, when they're introduced into the wild, there are some deleterious effects. What's happening exactly?
Well, the hypothesis by the supplementation hatchery programs or the managers of the supplementation hatchery programs was that the hatchery fish are more or less equivalent to the wild fish if they use the wild fish as a broodstock parent of hatchery fish, because they are genetically similar, they share the same genetic background. So we didn't expect any difference after we released those hatchery fish. That was the hypothesis.
And if that was correct?
If that was correct, we shouldn't expect any difference in a number of offspring from those releasing hatchery fish. But that's not what we found. We found clear decline in the number of wild-born offspring from those hatchery fish after two generations of those hatchery exercise.
And what does that show?
The supplementation hatchery fish in general is to use the wild fish as a parent of those hatchery fish. It shows the hatchery fish are not exactly equivalent to the wild fish.
But how can you tell from each time if you go back that you've got a wild fish and not one that you had released the previous year?
We knew it because we did the genetic parentage analysis, so we can specify exactly who are the parent of each single fish that returned to the river.
Okay. And what exactly is the impact of placing the hatchery fish in the river? What decline in the breeding ability?
What we found was nearly 50% reduction in the number of wild-born offspring from those hatchery fish who had a hatchery parent in generation earlier, comparing with hatchery fish who had wild parent. By having the hatchery grandparent, the number of grandchildren only 50% of the one who had the wild grandparent. That's what we found.
So with the first generation of hatchery fish, their offspring do okay compared with the wild type fish, but it's the next generation. That's where there's some suffering. A 50% decline, is that right?
Well, even the first generation, actually, we found a slight decline in the number of wild-born offspring. That's the result from this and the previous study. We see about 50% of reproductive success by the first generation. But in the second generation, the reduction was even more pronounced. If we compare those second generation hatchery fish to the wild fish that returned in the same year, the reproductive success was only 30%, meaning we lost 70% of wild-born offspring.
Why is this fitness declining, even among second generation?
That's a question we don't know yet. And actually, we didn't expect this level of fitness decline, which shouldn't occur in such a short generation in general from evolutionary perspective. But what we found obviously shows that. So we need to answer that question, but we don't have that yet.
Is it the environment, perhaps?
The domestication in a hatchery environment may impose a strong selection, which is far away from the optimum of the natural environment. But we don't know quite sure yet what factor gonna affect that shift in fitness. That's the question this paper is actually raising to the future studies.
Is that what's next for you along this research path to try and answer that question?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hitoshi Araki is lead author of a paper on the rapid cumulative fitness decline in the wild caused by the genetic effects of captive breeding. Read more about it in the October 5th issue of Science. Also this week in Science, a genetic explanation for choosing a mate. Different species of birds known as flycatchers do not often merge into a single species, even when interbreeding is possible. Stein Sater and colleagues report in a paper that the reason could be because female flycatcher hybrids tend to mate with a male of the same species as their biological father, even when fostered by a father of a different species. The researchers suggest that the mating preference is due to the inherited Z sex chromosome that contains genes for species-specific male plumage traits and mating preferences. Read the paper, Sex Chromosome-Linked Species Recognition and Evolution of Reproductive Isolation in Flycatchers, in this week's Science. Going green. It means implementing practices that are environmentally friendly. In this week's Science, news writers David Grimm and Benjamin Lester report on how scientists can go green in the lab and at conferences.
So what does it mean to green a lab, David?
Well, there's a few things that can be involved with greening a lab, but what I'm really talking about in my article is things that individual researchers can do. Things like recycling paper or using environmentally friendly chemicals, turning off lights and equipment at night, defrosting their freezers. So it's more simple things that researchers can do, which can still have a substantial impact on the environment.
And Ben, what about greening a scientific conference? What does that mean exactly?
The idea of greening a scientific conference is that by their very nature, flying to a conference and staying in a hotel and driving around on shuttle buses creates a lot of carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And sometimes these aren't as well looked at as they should be in the scientific community. And a lot of organizations are trying to change that, either by holding conferences less frequently or arranging with hotels to use the washing machines less to change members' linens, or basically everything that you can think of.
So are scientists the worst offenders? I mean, all this huff and puff about being green and environmentally friendly sounds like scientists aren't doing the best job. David?
Well, I'm not sure that scientists are actually the worst offenders, but they're sort of maybe the most ironic offenders, just because scientists are often the first ones to chastise the government for not being green enough. And you would expect if scientists of all people to be efficient in not only their daily lives, but also their work lives. So when you see cases of scientists not being efficient, either with traveling to meetings or with doing sustainable things in their lab, I think it becomes a lot more noticeable.
I'd echo what Dave said. I mean, clearly, when you're talking about big travelers, international business travelers leap to mind as the worst offenders. But the fact that even conferences on greenhouse gas emissions require people to travel thousands of kilometers to participate, you start getting into the area where you need to think about reducing how much you travel.
Well, on that note, Ben, does it really require people to travel? I mean, aren't there other ways of people attending meetings?
To some extent, yes, there are. There have been a number of different virtual conferences, and these conferences take various formats over the internet. Some of them are pretty high-tech with multi-screen video conferencing systems, and some of them are simple, you know, bulletin board setups where over the course of a month, researchers can post comments on an abstract.
So what's preventing change from happening? What's preventing people from doing more of this virtual stuff?
I think to some extent it's the formal conference sessions, at least for a lot of researchers, are the least important part of conferences. And the conversations over conference dinners and things of that nature are so much more important to them. And there's really at this point very little or no way to replicate that on the internet. And so you start getting into the realm where if you force people to do virtual conferences, then you really cut out a lot of the benefit that they gain from going.
Now, Dave, what about in the lab? What's preventing change there from happening?
I think one of the big things is that sustainability is really not a priority. I mean, researchers don't want to tweak their equipment to make it more energy efficient. They're afraid that if they do that, they're going to somehow muck up their results. And sometimes it costs money to do these things, to buy more energy efficient equipment. Researchers don't have the money to spend on that. And at the end of the day, researchers really aren't being held responsible for being sustainable. They're held responsible for getting their projects done. So it really does take a backseat, I think, a lot of the times.
other than buying more energy efficient materials and equipment and things like that, is there something that researchers can do?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of simple things. They can print double-sided on their paper, which a lot of printers do now. They can share chemicals or share equipment with other labs. That doesn't require buying new equipment. And the plastic versus glass issue is a little complicated because on first look, it would seem like, well, clearly researchers should switch to glass because plastic causes so much environmental waste. But glass has its own problems. Washing glass causes chemicals to go down the drain. You have to pay a dishwasher to wash glass. You're wasting water when you're washing glass. So some things aren't as clear-cut, but some things are very easy to do. And I think that's what researchers should probably be focusing on.
Is there something, Ben, that researchers can do perhaps at the conference themselves, given that they're already going to be traveling to them?
Well, if you start with the assumption that you have to go to this meeting, that it's the event where all of your colleagues are going to be and there are conversations that are going to take place there that you won't be privy to elsewhere, then you might consider offsetting your carbon travel. And there's lots of organizations that have sprung up to do this. The basic idea being that if your plane flight from London to New York generates X tons of carbon emissions, then if you pay somebody to plant Y number of trees or pump Z number of renewable energy kilowatts onto the grid, then you're in effect reducing your carbon emission footprint to zero. And this is a pretty contentious issue.
Why is that?
Well, there are some environmentalists that say that because carbon offsets enable you to feel okay, or at least a little better about your carbon emission footprint, they're robbing you of the will to actually do something constructive, be it changing to a hybrid or not traveling at all, or putting pressure on your government to change policies. That it's basically sort of legitimizing business as usual rather than instituting change.
Dave, how do we stop business as usual in the lab? Is it to give some sort of incentive to researchers?
I think researchers need incentive, just mainly because they have so many other pressures on their time and their money. Some universities have begun subsidizing researchers. Some people are going to do it because it's the right thing to do, but some people really want to make these changes, but they can't, and especially because they run into financial roadblocks. And if there's financial incentives there, I think labs would be a lot more likely to be sustainable. The program that I spent a lot of time at, which is the University of California, Santa Barbara, the guy who's leading the big sustainability effort there, Alan Doyle, offered pizza to labs that would shut off their hoods. And hoods are huge, fume hoods are huge energy consumers. They can blow through as much energy as three houses. And so just by shutting off a hood, researchers can save thousands of dollars in energy use. They can save lots of metric tons of carbon entering the environment. And this guy, Alan Doyle, was able to stop a lot of labs from doing this just by offering them pizza. Say, hey, there's a hood you're not using. Here's a pizza, turn it off. And he's actually had a lot of success with that.
Okay. Well, has reporting on this article changed how you're looking at your own life?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And Dave?
Yeah, I feel a lot guiltier about the things I do. So it's made me feel a lot guiltier, but it's also made me change some of my habits. So it's been a useful article to report on.
Thanks very much to both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Science News writers David Graham and Benjamin Lester report in two articles about how scientists are going green in the lab and at scientific conferences. Read about other scientists' efforts and pick up some tips for yourself in this week's Science. Also in Science this week, is being fair uniquely human? Keith Jensen and colleagues studied whether our nearest living relative, the chimpanzee, would play fair. In an experiment widely known as the ultimatum game, the chimps were given the opportunity to share raisins, fairly, splitting the quantity of raisins 50-50, unfairly, splitting them 80-20, or hyper-unfairly, no split, or 100-0. Whereas humans will reject unfair offers of 80-20 or 100-0, chimps only rejected 100-0 offers, in which the deciding chimp got no raisins at all. Read the paper, Chimpanzees Are Rational Maximizers in an Ultimatum Game, in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. Hi, David. So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We'll talk about why meerkats run towards their enemies, how you can fuel a car with eggshells, and finally, how a small fish invaded the Great Lakes.
How meerkats run towards their enemies, that seems a little backwards, doesn't it?
It does seem kind of backwards. You would expect that when any animal is presented with a predator, it would run away, not towards it. But that's not what researchers see with meerkats. They see that when something like a venomous snake approaches, the meerkats mob the snake. A lot of them, maybe about 80% of the colony, will run towards the snake. They'll start making noises, start clawing at it. Objectively, it doesn't seem like the smartest thing to do. And so researchers were wondering, well, hey, why are they doing this in the first place?
Is it to annoy the snake and make the predator run away?
Well, that was one idea. And so researchers really wanted to figure out what was going on. So they ran some experiments with this meerkat colony they had been following for a few years. They presented them with dangerous things like snakes and also not dangerous things like empty cages or moles or squirrels. And in either case, the meerkats would run towards these animals. But what was really interesting, even though a lot of the meerkats did that, the meerkats that were most aggressive about running towards either the snake or the squirrel were meerkats between 1 and 2 years of age. And these meerkats are sort of the adolescents of the meerkat society.
Is that kind of a daredevil thing then with them? Or?
Well, so that's one thing. Maybe, hey, they're adolescents. They're just being young and wild. But what's interesting about this age group is this is also the age group that participates a lot in babysitting and in guarding the colony. And these are both considered social learning experiences. So the researchers said, hey, if adolescents are participating in these other social learning experiences in high numbers, and they tend to be the ones that are most frequently mobbing in high numbers, then maybe this mobbing is a way of social learning. Maybe they're actually sort of taking a class in predator recognition when they run towards these animals. They're trying to teach themselves, hey, how can I better recognize a dangerous predator from a non-dangerous predator?
Okay. Well, speaking of invaders, what's going on in the Great Lakes?
Well, the Great Lakes are being invaded by a species of fish known as the round goby. And this fish was first thought to appear in the Great Lakes around 1980. People started seeing it. And today, most of the Great Lakes have this fish. And it's a real problem because it eats the eggs of native fish and it chases them out of their habitat. So it's an invasive species in all the worst senses of the term. But what's interesting is researchers really couldn't figure out how the fish got there in the first place. They assumed that somehow it got there in the ballast tanks of these large cargo ships that would go into the Great Lakes. And as the cargo ships traveled from one Great Lake to another, they were transporting these gobies. But there's just one problem with the theory. The problem is that these gobies are bottom dwellers and the ballast tanks are not taking water from the bottom. So how are these bottom-dwelling fish getting into the ballast tanks in the first place?
So did they make a discovery out in the wild or did they find something maybe in the lab?
Well, both. A group of researchers at the University of Michigan said, well, hey, maybe these guys aren't bottom dwellers all the time. And they based this on in tanks in the lab, they saw that yes, while the gobies spent a lot of the time at the tank bottom, occasionally, and especially at night, the larvae would float towards the surface. But they said, well, yeah, we're seeing it in the lab, but it's probably not happening out in the wild. But they decided to take a look anyways. And sure enough, a few years ago, they went out and started looking at some of the Great Lakes, and they noticed that at night, they were seeing a lot of goby larvae towards the surface of the water. And the more they looked, the more of this they saw. So they seem to have found the mechanism for how the gobies are getting into the ballast tanks. It turns out they don't spend their whole time at the bottom, and the larvae are getting into these tanks at night.
So does that mean that the way to get around the transport of these goby larvae is by only having the ships pump ballast water during the day?
That's what they suggest. I mean, they said, well, maybe if you only pump during the day, I mean, it's already a problem, but maybe if they only pump ballast water during the day, they could cause this to be less of a problem in the future. The only problem is if there's other species that get into the ballast tanks during the day, that introduces a whole other set of concerns. So it's a tricky problem to figure out, but at least they've solved one mystery here.
Well, from larvae to eggs, tell me about what's going on with the eggshells.
So eggshells are being used, or researchers hope they can be used, to help produce hydrogen fuel. And as you've probably heard, Rob, hydrogen is the future.
The future.
Right, right. Researchers want hydrogen-powered cars, hydrogen-powered this and that. And the reason hydrogen is so attractive is because once it's used, the breakdown products, instead of nasty things like carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, is water. So if you have a car that's running on hydrogen gas, it's theoretically only producing water as a waste product.
But producing the hydrogen, that's the problem, isn't it?
That's the problem. That's the problem. Getting the hydrogen in the first place. Hydrogen gas doesn't occur naturally on Earth. So manufacturers have to make it. And the way they make it now is from fossil fuels. And it's sort of a nasty process where the fossil fuels are converted to gas.
That gas produces carbon monoxide. They take the carbon monoxide, combine it with water, and that produces carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. So you're producing a lot of nasty stuff in the process. And a group of researchers said, well, how can we take the nastiness out of this process? And they said, well, maybe we can get something that absorbs this carbon dioxide that's being made so that when you're making the hydrogen fuel, you don't have as many nasty byproducts.
So that's where eggshells come in?
Right. Eggshells are 95% calcium carbonate, which is the same chemical you find in antacids. And what's interesting about calcium carbonate is that when you heat it, it becomes calcium oxide, which can absorb acidic gases like carbon dioxide.
Now, when you heat it, isn't that going to require energy and burning perhaps of fossil fuels?
That's a really good question, Rob, and I don't have an answer for you on that one.
Okay, so it's baby steps, baby steps.
Baby steps, exactly, baby steps. So these researchers said, hey, if eggs are made up of so much calcium carbonate, can we just use ground up eggshells to make this hydrogen production process a little bit but more environmentally friendly? And what they did was they found out that was indeed the case. When they ran some lab experiments, they found out that ground up eggshells soaked up about 78% of the carbon dioxide that was made during hydrogen gas production.
So what's happening with these eggshells now? Are they going into landfills? Are we pulling them out of some other process?
I don't think so. My impression is that these eggshells are just ending up as landfill waste. So you're actually recycling them in a sense and using them for good.
Are there any other advantages to this process?
Well, what's really interesting also about eggshells is that there's a thin membrane in the inside of the shells that the researchers have to remove before they actually do this process. And this membrane is about 10% collagen. And collagen can be used for everything from regenerating skin to plastic surgery. So they're getting multiple uses out of these eggs. They're not just soaking up the carbon dioxide. They can actually have medical applications as well. So talk about an incredible egg, right?
Right, the edible, incredible egg. Right. All right. Well, David, thank you very much. It was fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the October 5th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.